6 Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
6 Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new season of The First Time here on BBC 6 Music and BBC Sounds. Show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest, well, you probably know who it is from the song you just heard, but perhaps he won't be familiar with the whole of his story, the musical history he's been witness to and part of, his deep connections with the punk scene, and his experiences with a remarkable level of success, and, well, how he survived it all. My guest on The First Time today is Billy Idol. In this episode, the man born William Michael Albert Broad talks about a childhood obsessed with music and the first stirrings of the rebellion and flamboyance that would characterise his later career, and perhaps the key moment in his life, the birth of punk. Initially, as one of the scene's first front row fans, Billy was one of the Sex Pistols' infamous Bromley contingent, who helped define the punk rock look and attitude, but then as a member of early punk outfit Chelsea, and then as the singer with Generation X, one of the first salvo of punk bands to get in the charts. We, of course, cover the solo career that followed and the immense MTV-fueled international fame that he enjoyed, if enjoyed is the right word, in the 80s, and just what that can do to someone. He talks honestly about the 1990 motorbike accident that nearly killed him and his battles with substance abuse and addiction. And we discuss his comeback, something illustrated by his newest record, Dream Into It, his first full-length album of new music in over a decade. But I started by asking Billy, as I do with all my guests, when was he first aware of music?
Well, my mother was into jazz. She loved jazz, you know, so we were living in the States in the late 50s, and she just had Count Basie, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald, Dinah Washington. She loved jazz, so there was a lot of jazz music around.
I'm mad about the boy, and I know it's stupid to be mad about the boy. I'm so ashamed of it, but must admit the sleepless nights I've had about the boy. On the silver screen, he melts my foolish heart in every single scene. Although I'm quite aware that here and there are traces of the can about the boy.
There are also those kind of stage musicals were really massive at South Pacific, and she had Camelot. It was Richard Burton was King Arthur. And I wonder what the king is thinking tonight. He's bored. You know, just it was the kind of speaky singing. It was like, man, maybe this is wow, you can speak sing. You know?
I know what my people are thinking tonight as home through the shadows they wander. Everyone smiling in secret delight. They stare at the castle and ponder. Whenever the wind blows this way, you can almost hear everyone say, I wonder what the king is doing tonight. What merriment is the king pursuing tonight? The candles at the court, they never burned as bright. I wonder what the king is up to tonight.
But then really, I, as a little child, I 3 years old, I had, someone gave me Tex Ritter. He's like, he was a country and western singer. He sang, Don't You Forget Me, Oh My Darling, the High Noon theme. But I had these 78s, and it was him telling you kind of stories of the Wild West. He sang the song of Billy the Kid. That's what I liked. I liked, it was guitar and piano.
Some folks do a lot of good in the world. That encourages us to do good. A few people start off on the wrong foot. Their black deeds serve as a warning post to us. The song I'm gonna sing for you now, boys and girls, is about a boy who sort of wandered off the straight and narrow trail, took up a crooked course. As usual with all outlaws, he paid with his life. His name was Billy the Kid. I'll sing you a true song of Billy the Kid. I'll sing of the desperate deeds that he did. Out in New Mexico long time ago, when a man's only chance was his old 44. When Billy the Kid was a very young lad, in old Silver City he went to the bad. Way out in the West with a gun in his hand, at the age of 12 years he killed his first man.
When we moved back to England, it was right around the time of the Beatles had kind of appeared, and so that's what I really fell in love with. The first record I bought was a Beatles single, She Loves You. I got out of my own pocket money. I was going to buy From Me to You, but it was already slipping down the charts. But I just believed in them so much, I knew the next record's going to be great. So I saved up my money, and it was August, She Loves You came out, you know. So that's the first record I bought, 6 shillings and threepence halfpenny. She loves you, yeah.
She says she knows you're not the hurting kind. You know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad. With a love like that, you know you should be glad.
What was the record shop?
It was like there was washing machines and things like that. You know, it wasn't just a record. My dad took me. It sold washing machines and I suppose it had a record section.
For some people, music just becomes that obsession, doesn't it? It becomes everything in the world. Did that happen to you? Was there a moment when you were like, this is it for me. This is my life. Even though I'm a kid, this is all I'm interested in.
I did start dreaming about being on stage, being in a group.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I used to pretend, you know, like... Because at night I would listen to Radio Luxembourg, you know, underneath the covers, it would fade in and out. And it got hot underneath the sheets and that, so I'd start feeling like I'm on stage and sweating a bit. And because the Beatles were always sweating, you know. I just loved music, really. And I started to teach myself the drums at first when I was 7. And then when I was 10, I started to teach myself the guitar because I realised, oh, it's better to be at the front. And you got to write the song, so you got to play an instrument. But my granddad was a drummer, so he gave me a Ringo Starr snare drum. So I started off at first trying to play the drums, and then at 10, I got myself some sort of 5-pound guitar somehow. I don't know how I got it, really. I can't remember. But I started to teach myself the guitar.
What was the first song that you learnt?
Who the hell knows? I can't remember now. And then when I was like 10 or 11, I started making up pretend albums.
Really? Like what?
I don't know. I had really bad eyesight. So one of them was about my eyesight. And I had really bad, it's called Blurry Vision. And anyway, it was a concept album because each track was about your eyesight.
That's brilliant.
And then I'd do my own charts because the charts were everything back then. I don't know, when you were a little kid, chart placings were, that's what it was all about in the 60s. It was all, where's the record in the charts, you know? So I did my own chart as well. I do my own chart that week. So this is in my chart. This is what's number one. I love the Rolling Stones and the Who and them and the Animals. And then there were some teenagers would give me Rave magazine. It was a teenager magazine. And, you know, I'd watch Ready, Steady, Go. That's why we wrote the song, the Generation X song, Ready, Steady, Go. You watch that Friday night, the weekend starts here, you know. So, although I remember the Beatles are on Thank You, Lucky Star, 1963, and... I came home to watch them because, you know, it was just so exciting. They made life exciting. You know, the rock and roll music made life exciting. It just did.
What was the first gig that you went to?
Hawkwind were supporting Juicy Lucy, this band, at Worthing Town Hall. I saw them. They were really good. It was like my friend passed out from the white noise because they had a white noise machine. He passed out from the... They were on the Hurried On Sundown tour. We'll But a couple of months later, it was 68, 1 month before first album came out, Black Sabbath. It was the, you know, John Peel was playing their album on the radio, so we knew the songs. But, like, you know, when you heard that, boom, dang, in real life, it was like, it is the bowels of hell opening up. And Ozzy's tassels were touching me, so...
Sabbath at that era must have been quite the thing.
It was incredible. I was like 12 and a half or something. I was friendly with the kids who were a year older than me. They would take me with them, and there was no ID back then or anything, so they just let you in, you know. And we just saw everybody. We just saw whatever came through Worthing, you know, like Deep Purple, you name it. It was all those sort of groups, you know, that is the prog rock era.
Yeah. Having seen these people on stage, when did you think, all right, that's my job?
With these people I was going to the Worthing Town with, we're all talking about being in a group, and I've got a feeling I'm the only one who actually did it, you know. But all of us were saying we're going to be in groups, and I ended up doing it.
What was your first time on stage then?
So the first real time was when I was in Chelsea, really. We were playing on the floor in the Chelsea Potter. I was actually in a group in university where we did play on a stage, you know, the year before. I was in this little group. I couldn't talk them into doing punk rock music, but we could do early 60s stuff. So actually was it on a stage outside the university somewhere, actually. But the real first time was in Chelsea, was on the floor of the Chelsea Potter in down the King's Road. It was a pub, the Chelsea Potter. I think it's still there. And then a couple of months later, we... Generation X, me and Tony James left Chelsea and we started Generation X. It's a bit of a dream, you know. The groups all seem like they're having such a good time, haven't they? They're all having fun, you know, like, wow, then they go around the world. Part of me might have been thinking it's a way to get back to America, you know. I'd lived in America as a child, so my first memories are of being American, really, of having an American accent, you know, is sneakers, not plimsolls. You know, things like that.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about music that you love throughout this show. It's not just about your life. That early rockabilly stuff, you really love that, don't you?
I love rock and roll. So, yeah, I like a lot of the early rock and roll in particular. I mean, at one point, you know, when I was 7 or 8 or 9, you know, you're reading, you know, who do the Beatles love or who do the Stones love, you know, and somewhere or another I listened to the music that came before, you know, Little Richard, Buddy Holly in particular, because the Beatles talked about Buddy Holly. You know, they admired him because he wrote his own songs and played the lead guitar breaks, whereas, you know, Elvis didn't write his own song. And then, you know, people like Buddy Holly were still having hits in the early 60s. Peggy Sue Got Married and What to Do Now. And then Gene Vincent was in England, All in Leather. So rock and roll kind of carried on in America. It was dead, I believe, but in England it carried on, you know.
Please don't tell, no, 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 don't say that I told you so. I just heard a rumor from a friend. I don't say that it's true, I'll just leave.
Then it exploded. The Stones and everybody just exploded. And exploded into America, you know, it's where you saw it, wow, you know, really like, wow.
Don't need it to me.
do another first. Another first would be your first single, which would be Your Generation. Can you remember the first time you went into the studio to sort of do that? Like, you have this idea of it being on stage, and then you get to the studio for the first time, and it never works for any band, I think. But you came out with a good single at the end of it. Tell me about that.
We actually recorded first time would be we did some demos, for Your Generation, Ready, Steady, Go, and two other songs. I can't remember what they were. And then what we did was we bootlegged our demo, and we got this friend of mine, Steve Strange. He carried the demos around to this white label. We made white labels. So we got Steve Strange to take them around to, like, you know, at a Rough Trade. And they sold out in a flash. So the record companies hearing that were going like, wait a minute. Their bootleg just sold out. So it was a load of crap. It was us bootlegging ourselves, but it worked. So that's really the first record we put out. You know, it was this bootleg. And then we went in and we did Your Generation with Phil Wayman, because I like the Sweets drum sound. He was the Sweets producer, but he hated us because he was a drummer, so he was a musician. So we were driving him nuts because we took so long to get a backing track down. We were terrible, you know. He was always pulling his hair out, you know. He didn't last too long with us. And after that, we got Martin Russian, who produced the first album that we did.
I was looking at some of those really early TV performances. You were so confident really early on. Normally, like, you see people doing sort of TV and it's early in their career and they look a bit unsure and not quite sure where to be looking and they appear a bit uncomfortable. Whereas you were like straight out the traps. You were like, this is where I belong. Where's that come from, do you think?
I don't know. I spent my whole childhood watching people on television, really. That's what I'd done. I'd been drinking it in via the television because no one would take me to any of the shows until I took myself, you know, at 12 and a half. A bit like this album title, we're going to put our dream into it. I was dreamt into it. So I don't know what, by the time we actually got on television, you were super aware of what it takes to be on television in a way.
Yeah.
Because we'd just grown up watching all the, I don't know, Mark Bolan or someone, you know, T-Rex on Top of the Pops. You're just watching it, you know, going like, okay, I think I know. All the way through my childhood, teenager, that's all we did, was go to music things, watch people on stage, watch what gear they had, what guitars they're playing, you know. It's all that. We're just, all we're doing is thinking music, you know, nonstop. I mean, playing music, talking about it, reading about it, trying to write songs even, you know, or thinking about it, you know.
What was the first song that you wrote that you were really proud of?
I think Kiss Me Deadly, I think, really came out great, and that was the first song I think I was really proud of, you know, because it was really good.
The Greyhound's rocking out tonight to maximum rockabilly. When two punks choose to risk the subway for a tube to Piccadilly, whose efforts stir fast gangs for glory, another dumb casualty. Having fun in South of Six, a hit of flick knife flicks. Oh, kiss me deadly tonight. Another battle was won and lost down the Bishop's End last night. The spotlights pick the kids in triumph with a thousand scars in flight. See how they run. We'll spring from the terraces in black and white. Your nose into a fight. Having fun. Cause I was six to fight. We'll be right back.
Let's do another influence. Let's talk about Bowie.
Yeah, I love David Bowie. I mean, he was like a beacon of light to us in the 70s. He really was.
It did seem to be that way, because punk was all about just like getting rid of the old. But Bowie was different. It was like, oh no, we're keeping Bowie.
Yeah, he was fantastic. I mean, I got into the Velvet Underground and Iggy and every of the Stooges, but a lot of it was reading about David Bowie being in Max's Kansas City hanging out. And then you start realizing, oh, there's this band, the Stooges, you know, and they're hanging out with Lou Reed, Velvet Underground. We started to go away from the progressive rock and that and get into what was going on in New York, really, and the New York Dolls as well, the Dolls. I didn't see them. My friends saw them. Bowie was like that. I mean, he was like a gateway to a lot of things, a lot of music. I mean, he was like that throughout his whole life. He was a bit of a gateway.
What Bowie track should we play at this juncture?
I like that Conversation piece. It was a really early song that he did that is really killer. It's a great song. And then I think he redid it on Loving the Alien or something, but I think it's that early version, the 60s one. It's kind of, showed you where he was going to go as a songwriter. It really shows you, I mean, beyond, obviously, Space Oddity was killer. And then Conversation piece is an art piece of art that you talk about. I just read of all this, you know, like, oh. So I'm still reading about music and about David Bowie and how he's, you know, really important to us and still is.
Excellent choice.
I took this walk to ease my mind, to find out what's gnawing at me. Wouldn't think to look at me, that I spent a lot of time in education. It all seems so long ago. I'm a thinker, not a talker. I've no one to talk to anyway. I can't see the road for the rain in my eyes. I live above the grocer store, owned by an Austrian. He often calls me down to eat, and he jokes about his broken English. Tries to be a friend to me, but for all my years of reading Conversation, I stand without a word to say. I can't see the bridge for the rain in my eyes. And the world is full of life, full of folk who don't know me, and they walk in twos or threes or more. About the grocer store, investigates my face so rudely, and my essays lying scattered on the floor fulfill their needs just by being there. And my hands shake, my head hurts, my voice sticks inside my throat. I'm invisible and dumb, and no one will recall me. And I can't see the water for the tears in my eyes.
First hit. I guess King Rocker was the first hit, right? That was the first kind of breakthrough to the wider world. That still sounds great, that tune.
I think got in the top 30 with Ready, Steady, Go in Your Generation, I think. But I think you're right. King Rocker was like our biggest single, I think, at one point.
rockaroos straight out of Memphis. Well, Liverpool, Johnny Rocks, that round Paul place. That's the way history really comes down. Well, King Fitz King in the ring for the crown. Oh, King Rocker, a King Rocker. Shakes from the hip hop. Quasi kids in Lenzic Hamburg. Creole was sharp, but his guitar was acoustic. Go, go, Johnny, go, use your electric. Crazy man, crazy. King Rocker, a King Rocker. King Kong, King Kong. King Rocker, a King Rocker.
Did you enjoy being a pop star when it first happened? Did you enjoy like all the attention and the acclaim that kind of comes with having those hits?
Yeah, I mean, I did like it because I knew we were getting somewhere, you know, because that was the point. Because initially we'd done, we were doing punk rock, never thinking it was going to explode. We're just doing it for the sheer hell of it. The scene in America, CBGBs, was tiny and it wasn't going beyond... wasn't going beyond CBGBs either. And then there's only a few of us in England, really. When you think about it, how many people went into Malcolm McLaren's store? Is that, that was kind of ground zero at one point. So there's only a few of us. And even when it started, like when we started going to the Pistols at the 100 Club, because I was at university when my mate, Steve Severin, he became Steve Severin. He sent me a postcard, said, we've seen the band we've been waiting for. I think they saw him at Bromley Tech, saw the Sex Pistols. They said, you've got to get back up here. And they were doing this residency at the 100 Club. And, I mean, there's hardly anybody there. I mean, there's 10 of us or something. People would come off the street and their expression. It was the best. And Johnny would start haranguing them as well, like, oh, look at you all with your denim and your long hair. Why don't you go back to your Melanie Records, you know? Because they didn't really have an act, you know. They were just, in fact, half of it was Johnny slagging Malcolm off at the side of the stage. He'd be doing, Malcolm, why don't you get me a drink, you piece of shit? You know? I don't know. It was all kind of, it wasn't. But they were getting better week by week. Every week you saw them, they got better. And then they started to put their songs in it that they write in themselves, like Pretty Vacant first, and then Anarchy. When you heard Anarchy for the first time, it was like, they're writing songs. They're writing killer songs for our generation. It was like, this is what it's all about. This is it. It's fantastic. And so it's more like that. When I go on television or anything, or in the newspapers or whatever, it was more like, oh, we're getting somewhere. And then the Pistols, when they went on the Grundy show and swore it, and that lorry driver put his boot through the TV, it just, boom, overnight, everybody in England wanted to be a punk rocker. And like, and then there we were, all like, you know, every record company wanted their own punk rock group. So, but you could never have... You could never have planned that. We were just doing it for the 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years. It might last. If that's all there is, let's hell with it. That's what we're doing. And then kaboom.
They are punk rockers. The new craze, they tell me. They're heroes, not the nice, clean Rolling Stones. You see, they're as drunk as I am. They're clean by comparison. They're a group called the Sex Pistols. And I'm surrounded now by all of them.
In action.
Just let us see the Sex Pistols in action.
Shows you a little bit, like, if you do the thing you love, look what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
You do it for the right reason. I mean, they were kind of telling you at school there aren't any jobs. The no future thing was real, you know, like, they were telling you there's no... They were doing that, you know, no, there's no future, there's no jobs. They were telling you that. So we were going, all right, and we might as well do the thing we love. In my case, it was music. Some other people picked up a camera, photographed the scene, and then someone like Adrian Thrills, you know, he'd started a fanzine. And look, he's writing for the Daily Mail or something ridiculous. But that's kind of what people did, you know. And overnight, it went from just a few people being there to kaboom, you know, like, and there was a circuit, you know, started to be all the little clubs in London and, yeah.
When you moved to the States, like, 1980... Suicide are mentioned in the lyrics to the new single, aren't they? And I wondered if that was like, because I know you love Suicide, and that's one of the reasons, like, you went to New York was to connect. You didn't go to LA, you went to New York to connect with that scene there.
Well, that's kind of where you knew CBGBs, and you knew there was loads of other people, like-minded musicians, if I was going anywhere. Also, the record company was there. And my manager, I had an American manager, Bill O'Coin, you know, who managed Kiss, so he was there. And he also knew MTV was going to start, so... And I knew if I stayed in England, I'd probably end up just propping up a bar, you know, because, you know, in England, things go through really fast. People have seen you, you know, you're over. So it's almost better to go somewhere else and start again, somewhere else, and then come back to England, hopefully with some sort of success, you know. So I decided, OK, let's go to New York. We'll have a whale of a time anyway, and... I found when I got to New York after a few months, I realised this song we'd done on the last Gen X album, Dancing With Myself, was like really big in the clubs in New York. And I was like, because I was going around going, I know who Generation X was, but do I know who Billy Idol is? What music he does? And I really wanted to do the Dancing With Myself music, and I wanted to carry on doing that. And then one night I went to this club, Hurrah's, up on the west side of the 80s. And I was trying to get a drink at the bar, and it was really packed, you know, like, it's packed. I couldn't get through to the barman. And then suddenly the DJ, it was like there was a small dance floor, and there was like a load of settees and couches around the dance floor. No one was on the dance floor. And suddenly the DJ put this song on, and the bar emptied, and people just like went crazy to get on the dance floor. They're knocking the tables and couches and settees over, and then going crazy on the dance floor. And I went, great, now I can get a drink. I said, right, mate, I'll have a screwdriver. And then as I was waiting for him to bring the drink, I thought, I wonder what that song was that they all went mad to. And me if it wasn't Dancing With Myself. And I went, I don't have to change a thing. I know who Billy Idol is. I know what music I want to do. I just have to follow Dancing With Myself up. So...
Billy Idol album comes out, I mean, the doors are blown open. I always kind of think there's famous and there's 80s famous. Breaking America in the 80s, you're on MTV everywhere, every song's a hit, you're all over the radio. No one prepares you for that level of attention. Do you think you cope with it all right?
Well, that's right, yeah, you're not really ready for it. I mean, yeah, you want people to be into the music, so of course you're willing to put yourself out there, so to speak. But yeah, you don't really know. Yeah, like with MTV and everything. I mean, when I first got to New York, you know, just the cool people knew who I was. Most ordinary Americans had no idea. But then kaboom, when we got, yeah, with MTV and the videos and White Wedding and everything, everything went wild. And it was quite a different experience after that, you know, because then, you know, ordinary people watching television knew who you were, not just people into music, you know, went beyond music. Your image, and they could recognize me. I was so recognized. And I did, of course, you didn't go around in disguise, you know, you were living it 24/7. So, of course, you're walking around looking like yourself the whole time, you know.
Do you think that's why booze and drugs were a way of escaping that crazy life mentally, just to get away from it?
Well, probably. I mean, yeah, you know, you do start getting stuck in like little rooms, because if you go outside of the little rooms, it's crazy, you know, it's not normal, you know, in a way. And MTV was the latest thing as well. It was gradually, you know, it was getting bigger exponentially as more places in America and then around the world got it. So, you know, wherever you went, it started to be, there's no hiding from it. You know, people knew you're right in their face on television, you know, so it was a little weird, but, yeah, and the way to sort of deal with it was, yeah, to get high, really, and be in a little room and get high was the way to escape it all, or to find a level of freedom beyond it, you know.
Was there a point when you thought, I've gone as far as I can go with this? The fame is so big, the pressure's so big, this is not going to end well if I'm not going to get control of this. Because I cannot imagine the amount of attention, what it's going to do to you.
Yeah, I knew kind of, because I did become a bit of a drug addict and stuff. And so I knew in the back of my mind, I knew you can't stay like that forever. You know, so it's part of me is telling me that. And then, around the time, the early 90s, when I had the motorcycle accident and stuff, there were other things that happened. But, you know, those sort of things started making me. Also, I was on this pain box in the hospital. I was on this morphine pain box. It was like, it was so beautiful that I had to say to myself, when are you ever really going to be this high again, you know? Because they had me on a 12-minute lockout, you know, because otherwise I would have been, I would have not taken my finger off the, probably be dead. But after that, I kind of went, you know, bit by bit, I started to put drugs in the rearview mirror. It took a really long time. That's the only problem. It takes a long time to get sort of like a sense of discipline. Or I know the AA people say there's no discipline, but you never know what's going to happen. But bit by bit, I was able to, I think, to, you know, create for myself a sense of discipline where I'm not going to go there, you know. I don't go looking anymore. That's the thing. I don't go looking for drugs and stuff, you know.
Then you get this thing where, like, maybe it's a couple of album misfires in the early 90s, but then people sort of, it's not rediscover you, but the affection starts building again and starts building through the late 90s into, like, you know, you start playing these festivals like the Vans Tour or whatever, and then eventually get asked at Download. It's like everyone took you to their hearts again, which is kind of where you are now. It's kind of amazing to see. After having that issues, it must have been kind of amazing to have felt welcomed back by audiences again.
Yeah, we had to go a little bit back to the drawing board and stuff. But yeah, it's been great. I mean, I think that's what this new album is really singing about, really. It's singing about my whole life in a way, right from 77, which is sort of about the punk rock days in England and Too Much Fun maybe coming to America. You know, wild side relationships, you know, living this kind of slightly crazy life doesn't help sort of relationships a little bit because you're in the middle of nowhere half the time. I don't know. Left your own devices. And, sometimes you know, even like telling my parents, I'm leaving school and I'm joining a punk rock group. And, you know, they had no idea what a punk rock group really was. They knew what rock and roll was, but a punk rock group, what's that? So, you frighten everybody to death. But what started to happen was it came out with the in-ear technology in the mid-90s, you know, so because in the 70s, and I could never hear myself on stage. I could never hear myself, so why not get plastered up there? But once I had the in-ear technology, you could actually hear yourself. Oh, I can work my voice now. I can work it. So that was a big sort of thing in terms of continuing on, was now I can hear myself. So I can work my voice. I can enjoy being on stage in a way. I can enjoy it because I can, now like anybody else, I'm hearing what I'm doing. I'm enjoying it, you know. Not that I wasn't enjoying it before, but it was just like I could never hear myself with the monitors. I mean, and there were certain songs we couldn't do because I couldn't hear myself to sing it. You know, it'd be so low. And everyone's playing so loud. But yeah, once I had the in-ear technology, and that really helped me to really want to carry on being on stage and everything. And then playing with Steve Stevens, he's really great. And he's always stuck by me, really, through thick and thin, whatever I'm like or doing, you know. So meeting him was an incredible first as well, I've got to say, back in 81. My manager knew of Steve because Bill O'Coin had been watching what was going on in New York, and he knew of Steve. He didn't manage him, but he knew of Steve, and he kind of put us together. I said to Steve, you know, I've got to put a band together. I've got this EP with Moni Moni on it that was this follow-up to Dancing With Myself, which I'd done with Keith Falsey, and I said, why don't we just put a band together, and if we enjoy doing that, let's see what happens. And we carried on playing together for a long time now. Younger, back when I knew
the anniversary of punk, anniversary of Neurose next year. I think you're still punk. What does that word mean to you?
Well, it meant a level of freedom in a way, because it opened doors for us. It opened a door that I walked through, really. I dreamt into seeing the Sex Pistols, and a door opened up. This dream I'd always had, you know, I didn't know. I was in that little group at university, but now I'm seeing other guys like me. They don't give a shit. They're not that great at playing, but they're getting better week by week. This is it, man. The door opened up. Here we go. And next year will be 50 years since 1976 when I got in Chelsea and then Generation X that same year.
The final question, what song shall we end on? You get to pick the final track of the show.
I think I'm still dancing. I'm still enjoying what I do. I think this album's a bit of a rebirth. Yeah, maybe I've only just begun, you know. As it says in a dream into it.
Left my home for jet black gold. Sold my soul in a fever. Change my name in suicide.
Dancing by Billy Idol, the closing track on Billy's new album, Dream Into It, his first full-length album of new music in over 10 years. And thank you to Billy for being my guest on the first time today. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with another brand new episode of The First Time for this season. And you can go back and listen to previous first-time shows from this run on BBC Sounds, which include my chats with Jim Moyer, also known as Vic Reeves, Ezra Furman, Skin from Skunk Anansie, John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival, and Slick Rick. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.